Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Hornsby. Today, we're going to talk about how the Department of Education forgave about $700 million in student loans in one day this past week or about 2 weeks ago, and what it means for student loan forgiveness as a whole, what it means for all the advice that's given out there about student loans, what it means for you and your finances. So you guys know that you can ask questions on this podcast. We love featuring listener questions. So today we're going to feature a quick question from Ryan. Remember that you can ask your own question at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So let's hear from Ryan.
Hi, Travis. Question about pay versus IBR. We have loans from prior to 2007, so I had to use IBR if we wanted to do married filing separate. But we actually ended up consolidating the loans from prior to 2007, which were FFEL loans. So does that mean that we will now be able to use pay, or is it if you ever had loans from prior to 2007? Thanks.
Good question here. So what's being discussed is, like, if you've got loans from before 2007, that really is a buzzkill, because you can pay 10% of your income on pay as you earn instead of 15% with income-based repayment. So in terms of that requirement, you know, is there some sort of loophole, or what if you paid off those loans from before 2007? Could you get access to pay as you earn? Or if you consolidated those loans and got rid of them that way, could you get access to pay as you earn? The answer is no. If you have loans from before October 1st, 2007, then you cannot get on pay as you earn, even if you paid them off, even if you consolidated them. Now, there's one little exception, and that exception is if you got rid of those loans before taking out loans after that date for the first time. So in other words, if you had loans from before 2007, let's say you had those loans, but you paid them off before taking out new loans after that date, then you could qualify for pay as you earn. There's some pretty complicated rules with that. It doesn't apply to a whole lot of people, because almost always, if you have loans from before October 2007, usually those loans are still around, or those loans were around when you took out new loans after the date that you needed to in 2011. So generally speaking, no, if you can't sign up for pay as you earn on the federal student aid website, you don't qualify for it. So it's a good question. So now I want to talk about the main idea of today's show. It's how the Department of Education gave out $700 million in student loan forgiveness in a day. I'm just throwing out this number. It could be, this is really an approximate number. And I say in a day, it could have been over a couple of days, right? Like, so don't quibble on the exact specifics, okay? But this is really basically what happened. And how did it happen? It's because of the PSLF waiver. So remember, the PSLF waiver essentially said that we're going to give credit to anybody with any kind of payments, as long as they were employed full-time by a nonprofit or public sector employer at the time the payment was made. And we're going to give credit on direct loans, and we're going to give credit on FFEL loans if those loans are consolidated. And there's basically all kinds of credit for PSLF being handed out right now for people that have made payments in the entire history that they've had their loans. What's happening is the Department of Education is going through people's loan situations, and they're giving them extra credit in sort of an order. And this order is basically following sort of a certain pattern. So they're going to give everybody who's, you know, filled out all their ECF forms perfectly, but they were, you know, just missing the right repayment program or something like that with direct consolidation loans. They're giving a lot of those people sort of credit first, right? And then the direct loans that have not been consolidated, then they're looking at those loans. So there's sort of like a waterfall effect of who are they looking at first. And that's determining who's getting forgiveness when. So the first group of people that they're helping out are people that were on the wrong repayment plan on direct consolidation loans, from what I can tell. So they're going in, they're making those adjustments, and they're not waiting to forgive those loans if they determine that you've got more than 120 months of payments. What's happening in some cases is people that have direct loans are getting credited for more than 120 months of payments. And so if you look at your student loan account, what'll happen is your loan balance will go to zero, and then it'll show your principal as being negative. And so when you see a loan balance that's zero with a principal balance that's negative, what that indicates is that is the refund that you're expected to get when the student loan people are finally finished processing your information. So why does it matter that $700 million was given out effectively in a day? the reason it matters is because it totally, once and for all, I hope, destroys the narrative that student loan forgiveness is not real. This is a storyline or a thing that's pushed by certain personal finance experts that have either a moral opposition to it or it doesn't fit with their brand. Therefore, they say that it can't be something that should ever be considered. I will say that if your plan for your finances is to hope that a future administration like the Biden administration will magically come out of nowhere and rely on a national emergency authority to give you extra credit towards forgiveness on your student loans, if that is your strategy, then certainly by no means am I suggesting that's smart. But what I am saying is you have to bake in things like the PSLF waiver into your loan strategy. If you're not doing that, then you're just not getting the best advice. You're not approaching your student loans from the best possible way. So when you refinance and try to pay down your student loans, I think that's a great strategy for a whole lot of people. I think a lot of cases, it's a great financial strategy. In some cases, it's a good psychological strategy for people that are borderline cases where you could go either way. You know, if somebody is a borderline case of forgiveness versus refinancing, we talk through all the details, right? I want you to make the right decision for you long term. And I want to take into account what your personality type is. Are you a risk-loving person or a risk-averse person? Are you somebody that is planning on doing a bunch of aggressive stuff in your business or with your career that's going to result in a higher income? Or are you a person that's a little bit more lifestyle oriented, wants to have plenty of time to spend with the family, wants to primarily focus on working to live and not living to work? These are all things you have to take into account. But what I think that this PSLF waiver thing shows is that you have to take into account what could happen with the government and their policies. So whenever there is a narrative, right? Let's talk about narratives. Whenever there is a widespread narrative in the media about a specific type of student loan program, it ends up drawing attention on it, and there's a lot of pressure to change it if a certain party is in power. So for example, what was going on with taxes on student loan cancellation? There was a bunch of reporting in the media saying, like, this is why Biden can't cancel student loan debt, because the forgiven balance would be taxable income under IRS code, and therefore they can't do it because it would generate a bunch of money in taxes that people would have to pay, or they wouldn't even be able to pay it, and that would be disastrous for people. And so that reporting led to a specific policy action where in the reconciliation bill in January of 2021, the Democrats put a provision in there that makes student loan cancellation and forgiveness tax-free for the next 5 years for everybody. It's only for the next 5 years, though, because they had to do it within the bounds of reconciliation and they had to put a limited window on the time period for it. But that kind of shows you how Congress makes student loan policy. It shows you how the administration makes student loan policy, is they sort of look at a problem and they try to come up with a solution that is fixing the narrative. And so the narrative of public service loan forgiveness was that it was a broken program, full of broken promises, didn't fulfill what it was supposed to fulfill. Well, that narrative led to the Biden administration doing something really aggressive to create more people having access to that forgiveness. You know, CBS on 60 Minutes, they did a sort of a feature. It was so timely, you almost wonder if it was like coordinated on or something, right? Or somebody leaked something to CBS to tell them to do this story because they were about to make a major announcement. But they featured a bunch of military veterans and service members and showed how they had had such a hard time getting public service loan forgiveness and how it had been a program that had been a real nightmare for them to navigate. And then literally a couple weeks later, this PSLF waiver announcement came out. Looking at other kinds of loan forgiveness, what about your tax bombs? We know that if you work in the for-profit world or you work part-time hours, you're doing the 20 or 25-year forgiveness versions, you have to pay a tax bomb on the forgiven balance. If you're reading between the lines politically, it's pretty likely that that is never actually going to be owed. How do we know that? Well, think about the population of people that's going to owe it. It's going to be people who are professionals mostly, right? People that are employers in their communities, people that are well-respected and well-connected, and people that are probably swing voters. If you think about how higher income, highly educated professionals might disproportionately live in the suburbs, right? That's a very valuable political group demographically. If you ask that group of people in 20 years to pay their tax bombs, the vast majority of people, including professionals, don't have six-figure brokerage accounts. people tend to have their money locked up in their retirement, their home, and their businesses, depending on what their profession is. So you're effectively, with a tax bomb, going to be asking a bunch of people to remortgage their house, raid their retirement savings and pay penalty taxes, or raid their equity in their business. All three of those things are going to be extremely unpopular politically. So that means it's very likely that the tax bomb never ends up happening. That's one of the reasons why when we give advice to people, we are prospectively giving advice on what we think the future will hold and how those implications matter as to what plan you choose today. So that's one reason why we say, instead of people refinancing who have, you know, less than twice their income in debt, we have made that more conservative. We tell people, hey, if you're going to have student debt that's smaller than your income at some point in the next 5 to 10 years and you're working in the private sector, then refinancing is a smart strategy probably. Interest rates are near historic lows. There's 6% inflation in the economy. The Federal Reserve is buying all these bonds to keep inflation low. And so this is a pretty limited opportunity, I think, to refinance your loans to a super low interest rate. And we have basically 99% of the student loan refinancing market on our website. And we've got we're the only place that's got $1,000 plus bonuses with all of them, depending on the amount you're refinancing. You know the website for that, studentloanplanner.com/refi. Even though I love it when people refinance their loans multiple times and pay the debt down, get multiple bonuses, save a ton of money on interest, we know it's not the right thing for everybody. And the reason it's not the right thing for everybody is because stuff like this past couple weeks happens, where, you know, an administration comes out of left field with something nobody saw coming. And it's not just Democratic administrations, by the way. Remember who started the coronavirus pandemic student loan interest relief pause and payment and interest pause? It was the Trump administration. And it was literally the most random thing, where somebody once sent me an email that they were on the group in the Trump administration that helped decide how this waiver was going to look like. And they pushed for the interest to be forgiven, which is interesting, right? Like, it came out of nowhere. Nobody was expecting it. It just happened. You have to take into account these unexpected things when giving student loan advice, because you have to expect and predict what's going to happen with the future so that you can incorporate that into your plan in the present. What if you were not in the first batch of 10,000-ish borrowers that got forgiveness in the past couple weeks? Do you panic? Absolutely not. Remember that the PSLF waiver said, on average, the typical borrower is just going to get an extra 2 years worth of credit with this. Some people are going to get 10 years worth of credit, like the PE teacher who's 40 years old, who's been paying on their FFEL loans for 15 years. That person is going to get 10 years worth of credit when they consolidate. For people that have consolidated right out of residency and have done everything right from the very beginning, you're going to get 0 additional months of credit with the PSLF waiver. But your typical person is going to get a couple years extra credit, which for some people, like one person sent me an email this week, said, this is awesome. My forgiveness date just got bumped up from 2026 to 2022. And the issue with that is, when you have $700 million of student loan forgiveness happen in one day, the forgiveness disproportionately goes to people that have more levels of education and who typically have higher levels of income. The person getting the largest amount of loan forgiveness under PSLF is disproportionately a physician or a lawyer. And obviously, lawyers in the public service make pretty low incomes. Physicians obviously don't, compared to the population overall. So what I think that this is going to do, this massive amount of loan forgiveness that happened in a single day, I think that's going to move forward the political fights that are going to happen on loan forgiveness. I think that at some point, it's going to become evident to people making policy that this is a very expensive program. And eventually, there's going to be a couple reports that come out about the student loan program that are going to look pretty bad. And when those reports eventually come out, I don't know if it's going to be in 6 months or 5 years, but when those reports eventually come out and they talk about changing the rules, know that the Department of Education grandfathers people in, you know, doesn't touch the existing plans or programs people are currently working towards. They affect it for new people. Keep in mind, in the negotiated rulemaking that's going on right now, one of the points that the Department of Education has made is that programs that are written into statute, like IBR, ICR, PSLF, those programs cannot be changed. But programs that are written into promissory notes, like pay and repay, can also not be changed, is their position. And that's been the position of both parties, Department of Education's. So that's something that should calm you guys. I think that this is really exciting that this forgiveness is happening. for borrowers. I think that it shows how if you have a long-term plan, it works out. And there's definitely no way to eliminate risk completely. That's not the world we live in, right? People want to say, like, sometimes I'm getting emails like, oh my gosh, I want to refinance so bad right now because I'm getting a 2.8, but I'm so freaked out that Biden might just change his mind and extend the interest freeze for another year or something like that, right? There's not zero risk, but at this point, it's extremely low risk of something like that happening. And I would say, to be honest, for people that are refinancing their loans, like I like the 20-year fixed right now. There's still some really good offers. Even, you know, 2019, our 20-year fixed rates were like 5%. I mean, if you compare a 5% 20-year fixed rate to like a 2.75 20-year fixed rate, which I saw a couple people get this past week, there's no comparison. That's a massive amount of interest savings. And what we know with like the way economies work is they're volatile and that may or may not stick around, that opportunity. So, you know, I just want to make sure that people are thinking long-term about this stuff, that you don't let the headlines like freak you out, and that, you know, with PSLF waiver stuff, the Department of Education is going to be reaching out to you over time. It's going to take a while. And then plus there was news that came out recently that Fed loan servicing now will be kept on for another year. So now basically none of the big servicers, it seems like, tentatively, this might change again. I might do another podcast about this, but tentatively it seems like the servicers are not going to get moved over in the middle of the payment restart. So it seems like you will at least kind of have the existing servicer you're used to getting contacted by for the payment restart. And it seems like Department of Education wants to move people over to new servicers once they get everything back into repayment and get things a little bit more normal again. I will say again, Department of Education, full steam ahead on terms of restarting student loan payments. Y'all, they are straight up bidding in Google search on keywords now. The Department of Education is bidding on all kinds of keywords related to calculating your payments and calculating what your IBR should be and things like that. So that's a big deal. Like that's very evident that they plan on restarting payments on schedule on time. Most of the NSLDS's data that I'm seeing says like the first payment might get drafted around like March 2nd. You know, it's about 30 days after the January 31st date when the payments and interest restart again. So just remember that the payment's not going to get debited right away. And then plus for people that are really struggling, you'll have this, you know, 90-day window probably where they won't report anything negative to the credit bureaus, but it won't give you credit towards forgiveness, by the way. Like the payment and interest pause does definitively end January 31st, right? So don't like get distracted by that. Don't get hopeful that it's going to go longer than that. It's not. Even if we have a bunch of COVID cases come back, which it seems like the trend was going up a little bit when I recorded this, that's not going to be a reason to extend it either, because I think the reality is that the White House is very concerned about inflation now. And one thing that, and this is kind of a weird thing to say, but one thing that is inflationary a little bit is having no one owe anything on student loans, because people have a lot more money in the economy to spend. And one of the problems right now is there's too much demand with not enough supply. You know, all signs sort of point to this payment interest pause ending January 31st. Just know that there's going to be a couple to a few billion dollars of loan forgiveness that's going to be handed out over the next few months with PSLF specifically. It's very exciting. We'll be following it. We'll be talking about it. We're also going to be talking you through the student loan servicer stuff with those payments and interest restarting again, like all the fresh off the press gossip with student loan servicers. I know you just can't wait, right? You're like, oh my gosh, this is just the best thing ever. We're probably going to get into some wealth building tactics and strategies too, to talk about how to make sure that you're investing as much as you were, saving and accomplishing your financial goals as much as you were with student loans pause is when they restart again. So that's really important as well. So for the rest of today's show, I wanted to do something a little bit different. We don't very often at all feature sponsors on the podcast, but today we're going to feature one of them. Ben Martinek is somebody that I met at the XYPN conference in St. Louis a couple years ago when conferences were something that people attended pre-pandemic, right? Well, first off, let me say, Ben, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Thanks, Travis, for having me. It's great to be here.
In terms of like discussing what Ben does and why I asked him to be on the show. So basically, you guys know that tax return services are very difficult for people that are filing taxes separately for student loan reasons. Income-driven repayment, trying to file married filing separately to get a lower payment on pay-as-you-earn, and don't even talk about being in a community property state like California, trying to successfully allocate the income across the two different married couples' names to get the best student loan outcome, right? So we were sitting at XYPN, Ben, let me ask you what your recollection was. What did I say that I felt like our clients needed?
Well, I mean, you needed an accountant who just understands why you would purposely file separately on your tax return and perhaps incur a higher tax liability and why that would make sense. It's a common item that we run into with everyone we're working with, but it was a common item you were dealing with. I mean, accountants, they just would be left scratching their head trying to understand why. I mean, why would you purposely file separately? Simply because their understanding of student loans is really limited to maybe the student loan interest deduction, the college tuition credits that you pick up with the American Opportunity Tax Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. And that tends to be about the full scope of it. Not to mention that filing separately is ultimately more work on the part of the tax preparer, but it's going to be more work and a higher tax liability. Like, unless your relationship is kind of on the outs and you're concerned about jointly entering into the same liability as your partner, it doesn't really make a lot of sense in most circumstances to file separately. It usually isn't to your advantage.
The other issue is Form 8958 and community property states. There's about 9 community property states, basically in the Southwest and the West Coast, excluding Oregon. And we come across this all the time where people will need to split their income down the middle for student loan purposes. So like that's like, we call it the breadwinner loophole, right? The problem is I have very little confidence in telling somebody to use the breadwinner loophole and then telling them to go to TurboTax and correctly allocate on Form 8958 themselves. Ben, what has been your experience doing tax returns in the context of, you know, student loan borrowers over the past, say, couple years?
Well, I suppose to speak to Form 49 or 8958 briefly, that's a difficult form to complete in terms of the tax softwares. Several softwares on the retail side will provide the functionality for you to do this, but finding someone either within their own support or just within the support of the software as you read through it telling you how to do it is another thing. It's just not simply commonly done. And so you'd have to try to find that software engineer buried away somewhere in the heart of the company and say, like, how do we do this? Because getting someone who can actually walk you through the process is going to be challenging. It almost would be easier to paper file it than to use the support of the tax software. When we first started completing Form 8958, we had to have several internal consultations amongst ourselves to walk ourselves through the process of like, how do you do this? And so this is not commonly done, and it's a little counterintuitive in terms of what needs to happen or for it to take place. And as a result, even amongst tax professionals, we've seen very commonly with clients who come to us in which their prior tax professional hadn't completed the form correctly. It really is a bit of an advanced skill set to know how to do that. But, you know, in our experience, I think a lot of folks, just to speak about this a little more broadly, we have a lot of people who come out and are just really worried that if they file separately, either they're going to put themselves at an audit risk or they're going to really increase their tax liability by a large margin. And probably the big takeaway that I've seen in the last few years of almost exclusively filing separately for student loan borrowers is that in many circumstances, the increase in tax liability tends to be pretty modest to file separately. But the state student loan savings is huge. It's well worth the cost. I wouldn't want to say that's always the case, but there's many times in which filing separately is the right call. The increase in tax liability is not much. Somewhere between $500 to $2,000 is probably what we most typically see. I mean, there are circumstances, especially in a community property state, where there's zero increase in tax liability. You know, the community property state folks, you really get the best of both worlds. You almost incur no tax liability by filing separately, and you can save yourself a ton of money in student loans. So it's been really actually great to see how often filing separately is the right choice and to be able to work with borrowers to save them money, ultimately both between taxes. Maybe not so much saving taxes. There are actually in 2021 or 2020, we did see under the unemployment exclusion that was allowed in under that latest CARES Act, the ability to save money by filing separately if you're in a community property state. But you know, for the most part, the increase in cost, if I had to give one message to a listener, is the increase in cost when you file separately is not that much. Most professionals are going to be concerned, tax professionals are going to be concerned, it's a huge increase. But in my personal experience, it's uncommon. Now, there are times though in which it does increase a lot. We could take a moment here, Travis, and talk about when I've seen it increase rather substantially to file separately.
Yeah, and it's not the right thing in every circumstance. And you know, and you mentioned that. You know, when it does help is you know, when you're trying to exclude a spouse's income from your student loan payment calculation. You know, the obvious situation is when one spouse has loans and one spouse does not. You know, there's other situations too where both spouses have loans, but maybe one spouse has got a very small amount of debt, you know, and one spouse has got a very high debt to income ratio, and you might look at doing, you know, the pay plan for one spouse, the repay plan for another. So one thing that has come up, and this comes up occasionally, is we get letter, or you mentioned that, you know, State of California sent a couple of your clients a letter effectively saying, hey, wait a second, you know, you've used form 8958, split the income down the middle, and that's not matching what we have on your W-2, which obviously anytime you get a letter from a tax authority, it freaks people out. I've gotten them before for not declaring my HSA expenses in the right form. And it was a little terrifying. They said, here's all your penalties and interest. And so you were able to handle those forms for clients when California sent them that notice. What was the problem and how did you fix it?
Yeah, the common problem that we're seeing, and it really is very specific to residents of California. It's kind of surprising. With California being a community property state, you would think within their Department of Revenue, they would be aware of how to handle a community property state filing when you file separately. And the good news is they are aware of it. But what's commonly happening within their systems is that they're accepting the income being split 50-50 between two taxpayers. And so even though the income varies on the W-2, they don't seem to mind that. They're okay with it. Where they're consistently getting hung up is on the withholding piece. They'll see that you have a different withholding amount than what was on the W-2. And either they'll flag one or both spouses and say, you need to basically substantiate this for us. Because what they'll do is they'll retroactively go and change your withholding to what was listed on the W-2 and not what was being reported. Now, if they simply looked at the form 8958 on the federal return, they can see that, look, we're just simply dividing the withholding by two. It's spelled out very clearly on that form. And usually, actually, when we go to call into the department, we have been able to secure a number in which we have a dedicated department within California's FTB to speak to them. Thankfully, it takes just a few minutes for them to say, oh, yeah, we see what's going on here, and they can get the matter resolved. But yes, commonly we'll see tax bills, you know, they rewrite all the numbers. And so they'll say, oh, you owe $6,000 or $7,000, depending on whatever the withholding amount adjustment is. And, you know, that's obviously very scary to get a bill from an authority that says, you need to pay this in the next 3 weeks or additional penalties and interest are going to start to accrue. No one wants to open up a piece of mail that has that kind of language in it.
Right. I mean, I think you want to ask yourself, what is your main pain point as a person filing your taxes, as a taxpayer? For some people, I would argue if you had a very complex dental practice, I would argue that you might disagree, Ben, but my view is it's probably better to work with a very specialized dental-specific CPA and then try to explain these rules to them. But if you're primary pain point is student loans and filing taxes separately and splitting the income right, that's kind of what I really love y'all's firm for, is that it's a very high value service, it's niche and specific, and it's a very attractive value in the sense that it's not free, but it's not extremely exorbitantly expensive either. I know because I've had accountants of both types. Sure. But so let's talk a little bit more about some unique kind of circumstances. So one thing that people don't realize they can do is sometimes people file separate and actually shouldn't have, and it costs them, you know, a couple thousand dollars a year. You can go back and amend tax returns going with about a 3-year look back period. So can you explain what that is and how you're able to save people money with that?
Yeah, I'd love to do that, Travis. So you know, if you're not familiar, you can amend tax returns, as Travis is alluding to, under Form 1040X. That's allowed within 3 years. Basically, the IRS and any individual taxpayer or joint household has up to 3 years, basically, to call out something on the return. Again, both parties can do this. So, you know, the IRS can say, hey, we dispute something that you wrote down, and now we want to take a closer look at it, or we're going to disregard it. I mean, this is where we get these notices in the mail, or they want an audit or examination, and they're going to look more closely at your documents. Or as a taxpayer, you know, if you realize that a mistake was made and whoops, you know, we forgot to include this income or we didn't take this deduction, you can come back and change that, amend it, and get it fixed within 3 years of when the filing was initially due. So, you know, this upcoming deadline will knock off another year. The tax year 2018, you can only go back and amend that tax year up until this upcoming deadline of April 2022 here soon. amending is a fairly straightforward process. It's not uncommonly done. It's really geared towards if you want to change something on how you initially filed. Thankfully, as it is within the law, one of the things that you can change is your filing status. Now, it doesn't work both ways. It's very important to pick up on this. You can only change from separate. If you did married filing separately and you now want to change it to married filing jointly, that is an approved and allowed change that you can make and amend. But you can't change from joint to separate. Once you've passed the tax deadline, that filing status is locked in and there's nothing that can be done retroactively to go and change that. You have a joint liability or a joint return. If someone has only paid too much in taxes by filing separately, and now we want to go back and change that by changing their filing status to joint, it's really a straightforward process of just saying, we've decided to change your filing status as part of the explanation. You know, there's some numbers that have to be run through on that Form 1046, but the short of it is if there was an increase in taxes for that year, we can get that refunded back to you from the Treasury.
And I want to make sure we don't go too down in the rabbit hole of taxalese or whatever you would call it. Basically, the extreme case that we'll see is somebody's been filing separately forever and they're paying $5,000 a year extra to file separately because one spouse earns a lot more than the other one. And then we say, hey, wait a second. We do the student loan plan and we say, wait a second, you don't need to file separately. Let's go amend that from separate to joint. And $5,000 for the past 3 years, $5,000 times three is $15,000. You can literally go back and amend that return from separate to joint and get $15,000 back as a check, as a refund. So that's a big deal. One thing that we also ask you guys to help us with is when you've got a case where there is a very clear need for someone to file separately because of their student loan situation, but it is going to result in a several thousand dollar a year penalty or more because of that huge difference in spousal incomes, right? So this is a strategy that's sort of on the edge of what I'm comfortable recommending to people. I know that you might be a little bit more comfortable with it than I am. What I tell my consultants, right, is make a plan that is complex enough that saves all the money that we can save, but that is simple enough to actually be livable. You know, in other words, for me, like the file and amend strategy, which what that is for folks that don't know, is you file separately, wait until that return is no longer being used by your student loan, you know, IDR certification anymore, and then you amend that return from separate to joint to get that refund back of any penalties or extra money, I should say, that you paid for filing separately. Some people feel comfortable doing that for 20 years. Personally, that's way too long for me. You know, what I like for this strategy is that it's somebody who's an attending or who's doing PSLF. So there's like a limited sort of 5-year window where this is something that might save the money so that it's not just super open-ended. So could you describe what I'm talking about and where you've utilized it to save people a lot of money?
Well, we've filed probably a dozen or two dozen amended returns at this point. So not a huge number, but not a small number either. We have seen them get processed. I suppose as an FYI to anyone listening to this, amended returns aren't necessarily at the top of the priority list within the IRS. And so, you know, as nice as it would be maybe to get a $5,000 check in the mail, you should be prepared. But this is going to be a long process in coming.
Right.
Several months before they may even open it up and take a look at it. And then even weeks beyond that before they send that check and get it sent off. And you do open up the possibility for them to you know, want to inquire further. And so as much as this is a straightforward process, it's not necessarily a slam dunk where this is just, you know, we're going to have a check a few weeks later after we submit the filing. This could take several months and you need to prepare yourself mentally for that. Don't start spending the money in advance, I suppose, is what I would advise you on. You know, I suppose I'm blanking a little bit on your question there, Travis, but it's the actual process to amend the return is straightforward. A lot of times up until recently, it has had to been done by paper. We still do that with a few clients if we hadn't completed the original return. The IRS here recently in the last tax year or so, and starting with 2019, is now allowing electronic submission of amended returns, which is speeding up the process. But it's still several weeks to months in the waiting before they're going to get this settled out.
Well, and you know, there are some strategies that save so much money that you can't ignore them. Like the filing separate strategy, amending the return, making the returns equalized in income if you're in a community property state sometimes. There's strategies that are so good, you can't not do it. There's the double debt loophole, pay, repay. Sometimes that makes tons of sense. But yeah, I mean, this is an example of sort of a extreme strategy that it's not going to apply to a whole lot of people. but it does apply to some people, and the people that it does apply to can save a huge amount of money on this. You know, people too that file separately for PSLF. I bet you there's a ton of people, Ben, that file separately for PSLF the whole way and get their loans forgiven, and the loans are gone, and they just leave money on the table and never amend those returns, and that's thousands of dollars that they could get back.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you're bringing that up because, you know, folks sometimes have a weariness with going back and amending, especially if it's PSLF. They already feel like they're getting a good enough deal from the government to have all the loans wiped away and not have any tax bomb associated with it. So they don't want to do anything, even as much as I'm confident that this is on the up and up. And certainly the IRS is not going to give us an issue over amending them. Some folks still are concerned maybe the Department of Education won't grant forgiveness if they're aware of this practice that they've been going back and amending their tax returns. But, you know, certainly once the loans are forgiven and that's a done settled matter, I mean, there's no question. I mean, you should go back and amend those tax returns, presuming you did increase or incur a higher tax liability as a result. Now, our own internal practice at this point in time is to delay amending by about 18 months after the initial submission date, mostly because we want that tax return to stay with the Department of Education long enough that we're not concerned that they're going to come back and have to relook over it. So we've seen a few folks who amend the tax return as soon as they get their income certified on that tax year in question. I think that's a little too quick, just in case there's ever need for the Department of Education to take a look and want to see if you need some documentation. So we wait 18 months to 2 years roughly before we go back and amend a tax return. We're well into another tax year or two at that point in time. But other than that, I mean, I think it just makes sense. It isn't too much work on our part. We've set ourselves up in which we already complete the tax returns as joint. And then when we go to separate them out, we basically have that joint return on file ready to go. So we know immediately right away how much you are paying at the difference in taxes between filing separately and jointly. And then, you know, in a future year, if it makes sense to go back and amend to that joint return, there isn't a whole lot of work on our part to go and make that switch over. It's just a matter of double checking everything and making sure that the numbers are still tallying together the way we thought they should.
You know, the last thing I want to cover is, you know, so we've talked a lot about student loan stuff. We talked a lot about stuff that may have put some people to sleep. So wake up, folks. Here's the reality, right? If you want somebody for a very reasonable fee that's going to know of student loans and know how the forgiveness programs work and the, you know, income-driven programs work in the context of filing your taxes, studentloantaxexperts.com is where you want to go, right? So for our listeners, Ben, if they go to studentloantaxexperts.com, the first thing you see is schedule a free call. So they can go and schedule a free call and mention that they found out about you guys from Student Loan Planner. You guys have a new fee structure to make sure that people can ask any questions that they want to ask, right? So can you just briefly describe what people would do if they were interested in potentially working with you guys?
Yeah, for sure. I'd love to, Travis. So again, yeah, studentloantaxexperts.com is where you'd like to go. We do introductory calls. They take about 15 minutes. We go over your situation, the reasons that bring you to the call that day. We'll see if we can provide some general advice and recommendations or guidance on that call in and of itself. But it is just 15 minutes, and we only do wrap up the call discussing our service offerings. And so we help as much as we can, but you know, ultimately, we're looking to see if you're interested in a paid service with us, in which we can get more into the nuts and bolts of your situation and give you that definitive help you're seeking. So we do have two basic types of services when it comes to tax preparation. One's a more budget-friendly a la carte arrangement. So if you're just simply looking for someone to complete that tax return who understands why you're filing separately, you don't have to get any pushback from the accountant as to why would you file separately. Like, we get it, we understand, we can even tell you what we expect your payment to be now that we have your AGI calculated and the whole bit. So we'll be able to walk you through the process of getting that tax return done. And if that's really all you're needing to have done, then the a la carte service really can make a lot of sense. We'll bill you to complete the tax filing, and then we'll just meet you again next year when it's time to do more tax prep. But we have some other clients who are looking for ongoing assistance, whether it's in their tax situation or in their student loans, or they would like just to know that we're available on a phone call away. That is at a higher price point under what we're calling our retainer service. But we certainly give a more of a white glove approach to all our retainer clients in terms of meeting with them, walking them through the tax filings, and then ultimately making ourselves available in the off season, either to run tax projections or take field any questions a client might have about whether or not they should maybe contribute more to their 401k or the impact that might have on their student loans, or you know, if they're considering rental properties, what are some good planning ideas, business ideas to be pursuing. And so, you know, we have, again, this a la carte arrangement. If it's more budget friendly, that's really geared to completing that tax return, or the retainer arrangement, which is a more open availability, us becoming your tax advisor, student loan advisor as needed.
Yep. So I think people might ask, well, how do services like your guys' work? We do more student loan plans than anybody in the country, right? So you can get your student loan plan from us. I did not want to do tax returns. I thought about it. We thought about it. I thought about trying to convince Ben to join Student Loan Planner to just do tax returns so we could do them in-house. But ultimately, I felt like we needed to do what we were best at, and then work with other folks, sponsors, people like that, to do other things that our listeners and our audience needs. So studentloantaxexperts.com, book a free call. I will say, when you're thinking about tax help, don't wait, folks. I am in the midst of going through a tax filing change myself, and I started the process in like late October, and it's like a mad dash to get everything done before the end of the year right now. So if you wait like till December to get someone lined up to do your taxes, or heaven forbid, like the first quarter of 2022,
yeah,
right? Like, you're going to have a hard time. People are not going to be able to, you know, really even maybe even respond to your email. So don't wait to at least think about your tax filing for 2022 calendar year. I used to do my tax returns myself, Ben. I used to love doing it on TurboTax. The moment that I stopped love doing it was when it was anything more complicated than fill in your, you know, in 1099 divs and fill in your, you know, wage income. Like, when it was more complicated than that, I said, heck no, I need somebody. So site sponsor, studentloantaxexperts.com, book a call with Ben and his team. I think they just added a tax lawyer as well. Is that right, Ben?
That is, yeah, a tax attorney, I suppose, is how we often refer to her. But yeah, she's got a legal background, went to law school, and then focuses exclusively in tax-related matters, which is super valuable for us. Ultimately, all tax concerns are ultimately legal concerns, because it's ultimately the Internal Revenue Code that is the defining authority on all these matters. And so if we needed to go to the highest authority when it comes to tax, it's ultimately going to be the tax court. And you need only representation there from an attorney for the most part, in order to be able to resolve those matters out. So,
yeah,
you know, if you really want to be able to know the ins and outs of taxes, the IRS publications are great, but they actually aren't in and themselves an authority. You got to be able to turn to the Internal Revenue Code. So we've got a tax attorney on staff who's happy to get into that legalese. So this is where I draw the line. You know, you were drawing the line earlier on, you know, how much tax work you want to do. You know, I draw the line on how much legal verbiage do I have to push through before to get a correct understanding of something. Thankfully, we have our attorney to help us out there.
And I don't think anybody wants to go into IRS code, you know, so that's good. It gives people a little bit added relaxation, right? That the stuff that's being discussed is not edge pushing where you're going to go to jail or something. You know, I mean, that's not at all what's happening here. This is reasonable, conservative, you know, strategies that are not going to get you in trouble, or not going to get you, you know, worst case scenario, you have like a notice from the state of California saying, hey, our numbers don't match up with yours. And then you have a tax person that can kind of help make sure that you don't have to be stressed about it. Right. Thank you, Ben, for being on the show. studentloantaxexperts.com. Appreciate having you on.
Yeah. Thanks, Travis. It's been a pleasure. Look forward to working with you. Travis is really just awesome, guys. I think you guys already know that, but I want to just give a plug back to Travis. He's just been fantastic to work with. I couldn't ask for a better sponsor.
All right. Thanks, everybody.